soldiers, Hiram Schenck's hysterics, Count Kerrigan calling.
Then you won't be staying for dinner,
from the steps of his house as their party beat a hasty retreat to the palace. When they finally entered the king's sitting room and Isaac stripped off his wet coat, he was prepared for a long night of strategizing and recriminations. Instead, Tamar threw herself down on the couch and burst out laughing. Tolia picked up David in one arm and Jenya in the other and spun them both around.
Brilliant,
gasped Jenya, thumping on Tolia's shoulder so he would set her down.
A performance worthy of the too clever fox himself.
The way Schenck squealed, crowed Tamar. I think he may have wet himself.
I almost did the same, said Tolia. Was the missile supposed to hit the mast?
Of course it was, David said sternly. You said you wanted a spectacle.
Jenya planted a kiss on his cheek and repeated,
Brilliant.
Isaac stared at them.
Then that wasn't a disaster? It was a triumph, said Tamar.
I see, said Isaac.
Oh, Isaac, said Jenya, I'm so sorry. We just weren't sure you could feign real surprise.
We needed your reaction to be natural, Tamar said.
Tolia's face was contrite.
We only had one chance to get this right.
Isaac sat down on the couch.
Damn it.
We're sorry, Jenya said, crouching at his knee and looking up at him imploringly. Truly.
Can you forgive us?
Asked Tolia.
I was just so excited,
Isaac said. He pulled off his left boot and watched it spill what looked like half a lake onto the carpet.
Finally, something went wrong, and I had nothing to do with it.
Chapter 27 Nikolai. The night before the ritual, Nikolai sat with Zoya in front of the fire in his chambers. Yuri had retreated early to pray. The fire in the grate was wholly unnecessary. The fold was neither hot nor cold. Weather would have required some kind of change in the punishing monotony of this place. But the flames were all they had for entertainment, and Nikolai was in desperate need of distraction. He had insisted he was ready for the ritual. Elisaveta had wanted to delay for a few more days so he could solidify his control. But Nikolai was unwilling to risk it. He needed to get back to the capital. But it was more than that. He could sense the monster getting stronger with every day, and he suspected that it had become easier to make his demon rise because it wanted to stretch its wings. It could taste the possibility of freedom.
Just a little longer,
Elisaveta had said. But Nikolai had held firm.
Tomorrow,
he'd told her. Or whatever passed for tomorrow in this cursed place. He had never wished for sleep more. For some relief from thoughts of the challenge to come. He could sense the monster waiting. Somehow it knew that tomorrow they would face each other, and it was ready. Its anticipation was more frightening than the fact that he would have to drive a thorn through his chest in a matter of hours. Nikolai craved a glass of wine desperately. No, skip the glass, he'd go straight to the bottle. But there was no wine to be had. No food to fill a plate. He was hungry, and yet his stomach never growled. He was thirsty, and yet his mouth was never dry. Nikolai watched Zoya watching the flames. She flexed her fingers, and the sparks leapt. He still could not quite fathom what Joris had taught her in this short time. She wore the same clothes she'd worn the morning they'd disappeared, though the rough-spun cloak had long since been discarded. He was grateful for the familiarity of the deep blue silk of her kefta. She sat with a knee tucked up, one cheek resting against it. Nikolai realized he'd never seen her look so at ease. At court, Zoya always moved with grace, her step smooth, her gaze sharp and unforgiving as the blade of a knife. But he realized now it was the grace of an actress on the stage. She was always performing, always on guard, even with him. Nikolai released a startled laugh and she glanced over at him.
What is it?
He shook his head.
I think I'm jealous.
Of what?
A dragon.
Don't let Joris hear that.
He thinks enough of himself as it is.
He should. He can fly and breathe fire, and he's probably got piles of gold stashed somewhere.
That's an unfair cliché. It could very well be jewels.
And he made you look like that.
Zoya raised a brow.
Like what, precisely?
Comfortable.
Zoya's back straightened, and he felt tremendous regret at seeing her armor lock back into place. After a minute, she asked,
What do you think will happen when we leave this place?
Hopefully not too many things will be on fire.
Zoya sighed.
David and Kuwe have been left unattended too long. For all we know, they've blown up half the capital.
That is worryingly plausible,
admitted Nikolai. He scrubbed a hand over his head. Red wine. White wine. That drink made with fermented cherries he'd tried at the Crow Club. Anything for a little respite, a night of real rest. Not even Jenya's sleeping concoction worked here. It just made his mind sluggish.
I don't know what we'll find. I don't even know who I'll be tomorrow.
You will be who you were always meant to be. Ravka's king.
Maybe,
he thought.
Or maybe it will be left to you to set Ravka to rights.
He removed a folded document from his pocket and placed it beside her hand. She picked it up and turned it over, frowning at the wax seal he'd impressed with his signet ring.
What is this?
Don't worry, I haven't written you a love letter.
She turned her face to the fire. Was even the mention of love too much for Zoya's ruthless sensibilities?
This is a royal order, declaring you Ravka's protector and making you commander of both the first and second armies.
She stared at him.
Have you lost your wits entirely?
I'm trying to do the responsible thing. I think it's giving me indigestion.
Zoya tossed the letter to the floor as if the paper had singed her fingers.
You don't think you're going to survive tomorrow?
Ravka's hopes shouldn't live and die with me.
So you're pinning them on me instead?
You are one of the most powerful Grisha the world has ever known, Zoya. If anyone can protect Ravka, it's you.
And if I tell you I don't want the job?
We both know better. And did I mention the position comes with some truly spectacular sapphires?
Nikolai rested his hands on his knees.
If the twins and the triumvirate weren't able to hide our disappearance, Ravka may already be in turmoil. We both know it's possible I won't survive the ritual, and someone will have to restore order. Every man and woman who claims to have a drop of Lanthoff blood will make a bid for the throne. And our enemies will seize the chance to tear the country apart. Pick one of the pretenders to back. The smartest or the most charming or...
The most easily controlled.
You see, you were made for this. Rally the Grisha. Try to save our people.
Zoya gazed into the fire, her expression troubled.
Why is it so easy for you to contemplate your death?
I'd rather look at a thing squarely than let it catch me by surprise.
He grinned.
Don't tell me you'd miss me.
Zoya looked away again.
I suppose the world would be less interesting without you in it.
I wouldn't let myself be drowned in amber for just anyone, you know. I'm touched, he said.
And he was. It was the closest thing to a compliment she'd ever given him. She drew a slender chain from the neck of her kefta and pulled it over her head. The key she had used for his shackles. She dangled it from her finger.
We won't ever need this again after tomorrow.
He took it from her, feeling the weight of it in his palm. The metal was warm from her skin. He hadn't missed their nightly ceremony, but he'd missed having an excuse to talk to her each evening and each morning. He supposed that would be at an end now, too. Nikolai hesitated. He wasn't anxious to spoil her goodwill.
Your amplifier.
Zoya's hand twitched, and he knew she was resisting the urge to touch her bare wrist.
Will you tell me how you got it?
Why does it matter?
I don't know that it does.
But he wanted to know. He wanted to sit here and listen to her talk. For all the time they'd spent together, Zoya was still a mystery to him. This might be his last chance to unravel her. She smoothed the silk of her kefta over her knees. He thought she might not speak. Just sit there, silent as a stone, until he gave up waiting. Zoya was perfectly capable of it. But at last, she said, I was 13. I had been at the little palace for almost 5 years. The Darkling took a group of Grisha to Sabea. There were rumors the White Tigers of Ilmisk had returned, and he suspected at least one of them was an amplifier.
Near the permafrost?
A little farther south. I was the youngest of the group, and so proud to be chosen to go. I was half in love with him already. I lived for the rare moments he appeared at the school. She shook her head. I was the best, and I wanted him to see that. The older Grisha were all in contention for the amplifier. It was up to them to track the tigers and see who would earn the right to the kill. They followed a female for nearly a week and cornered her in the woods near Chernost. But she somehow escaped their grasp. Zoya wrapped her arms around her legs. She left her cubs, abandoned the three of them. The Darkling's men penned them in a cage so the Grisha could squabble over who deserved their teeth the most. All night, we could hear the mother prowling the perimeter of the camp, snarling and yowling. My friends talked about going into the dark to pursue her. I knew they were all bluster, but I couldn't stop thinking about the cubs. So, when the camp was asleep, I created a distraction for the guards by knocking over one of the tents with a gust of wind. And I chased the cubs out of the cage. They are so little, she said with the smallest smile. They couldn't really run, only roll a bit, stumble, right themselves. I just kept them moving away from the camp. Saints, I was scared. Her eyes were far away now, as if looking into that long-ago night. We were still inside of the torches when I realized I wasn't alone.
The mother.
She shook her head. A male. I don't know why, but he went straight for the cubs. I panicked. I should have fought, used my power, but all I could think to do was cover their bodies with mine. When the male attacked, his claws tore clean through my coat and my kefta, all the way to the skin of my back. Zoya's fists clenched. But I protected those cubs. I remember I had my eyes squeezed shut, and when I opened them, the snow looked black in the moonlight. She turned her face to the fire. It was stained with my blood. I could feel the cubs wriggling against me, yowling their terror, their little claws sharp as needles. That was what brought me back to sense, those tiny, vicious little pinpricks. I gathered the last of my strength and summoned the most powerful gust I could. I threw open my arms and sent the male flying. That was when the Darkling and his guards came running. I guess I'd been screaming.
Did they kill the tiger?
He was already dead. I struck a tree when I threw him. It snapped his neck. The cubs escaped. Zoya rose. She turned her back to him and, to his astonishment, shrugged the silk of her kefta from her shoulders, letting it pool at her hips. An unwelcome bolt of desire shot through him, and then he saw. Along the smooth skin of her back lay 8 long, furrowed scars. The other Grisha were furious, she said. But I had killed the White Tiger. The amplifier could only belong to me. So they bandaged my wounds, and I claimed the tiger's teeth for my wrist. He left me with these. The firelight caught the pearly surface of the scars. It was a miracle she'd survived.
You never had them healed.
Tailored. She drew the kefta back up to her shoulders and fastened the clasps. He left his mark on me and I on him. We each did each other damage. It deserves to be remembered.
And the Darkling didn't deny you the amplifier despite what you'd done?
It would have been a fair punishment, but no. An amplifier that powerful was too rare to waste. They put the fetter on me, bound the old cat's teeth in silver so that I could never remove it. That's how all of the most powerful amplifiers are fashioned.
She gazed out the open frame of the window to the flat gray expanse of the sky.
When it was all over, the Darkling had me brought to his tent and said, "So, Zoya, you freed the tiger cubs. You did the selfless thing. And yet, somehow, you are the one who has finished the day with great power. More than any of your betters, who have patiently waited their turn, what do you say to that?" His disapproval was more painful than any wound from a tiger's claws. Some parts of me always feared that he would send me away, banish me forever from the little palace. I told him I was sorry. "But the Darkling saw me clearly even then. Is that really what you wish to say?" he asked. Zoya pushed a dark strand of her hair behind her ear. "So, I told him the truth. I put my chin up and said, 'They can all hang. It was my blood in the snow.'"
Nikolai stifled a laugh, and a smile played over Zoya's lips. It dwindled almost instantly, replaced by a troubled frown.
That pleased him. He told me it was a job well done, and then he said, "Beware of power, Zoya. There is no amount of it that can make them love you."
The weight of the words settled over Nikolai.
"Is that what we're all searching for?
Was that what he'd hunted in all those library books? In his restless travels? In his endless pursuit to seize and then keep the throne?"
"Was it love you wanted, Zoya?"
She shook her head slowly.
"I don't think so. I wanted strength, safety. I never wanted to feel helpless again."
"Again?"
It was impossible to conceive of Zoya as anything less than mighty. But all she said was,
"When Juris broke that fetter, it was like he'd torn a limb from my body. You cannot imagine it."
He couldn't, and he couldn't imagine what words might bring her comfort.
"What became of the cubs?"
Zoya ran her finger over the window ledge, sand trailing from it in a glittering fall.
"He told me. The Darkling said that because they had my scent on them, the mother wouldn't raise them."
Her voice wobbled slightly.
"He said that I doomed them, as surely as if I'd taken a knife to their throats myself. That she'd leave them to die in the snow."
"But I don't believe that, do you?"
Her face was composed, but her eyes were imploring. Nikolai felt as if he were looking at the young girl she'd been on that cold and bloody night.
"No," he said. "I don't believe that at all."
"Good," she said.
"Good."
She gave her cuffs a firm tug, seeming to return to herself.
"Every lover I have ever taken has asked about those scars. I make up a new story for each of them."
He found he did not want to think of Zoya's lovers.
"And what did I do to earn the truth?"
"Offered me a country and faced imminent death."
"It's important to have standards, Nozulensky."
Zoya bobbed her chin toward the sealed order that still lay on the floor.
"It's not too late to burn that."
Nikolai thought of the smooth planes of her back striped by those furrowed scars. He thought of the stubborn tilt of her chin. He imagined her huddled in the snow, risking her position with the mentor she worshipped. Risking her very life to save those cubs.
"The more I know of you," he said, "the more I am sure you are exactly what Ravka needs."
In that moment, he wished things might have been different. That he might not die tomorrow. That he could be led by his heart instead of duty.
"Because Zoya was not kind, and she was not easy. But she was already a queen."
Chapter 28 Nina. Nina had never sat through such a long, strange dinner. One of the prettier rooms off the chapel had been set with a private meal for Broom, his daughter, and her new language teacher. The food was a marked improvement on the simple fare of the convent. Seared perch, served with mussels, cabbage shoots and cream, smoked eel, pickled mushrooms, and braised leeks. Nina tucked two tiny quail eggs into her skirts in case Trossel had a taste for the finer things, and found herself wondering if they might finish with sugared almond cookies. One could plot violent espionage and still hope for dessert. Broom had questioned Adric and Leonie that afternoon, and apparently their answers had satisfied him. Nina had expected Adric to refuse to continue on with their plan now that they were facing the Druskella commander's scrutiny, but he'd surprised her.
"I always figured I'd die young," Adric said, gloomy as ever. "Why not do it shoving my boot up that murderer's ass?"
Tonight, she was Nina Zenek, seated across from her greatest enemy, Matthias's former mentor, and the architect of some of the worst crimes against her people. But she was also Mila Yanderstadt, a poor girl dining with those high above her station, all while watching her friend suffer. And Hannah was her friend. She thought of Hannah sneaking away from the convent to deliver an unwanted child. She thought of her crouched over the neck of her horse, racing through the fields. Of her standing in the classroom, hands raised in a fighting stance, cheeks flushed. A warrior born. She had a wild, generous streak that could bloom into something magical if it was only allowed to flourish. That might happen in Ravka. It was definitely not going to happen at this table. Broom subjected Hannah to endless questions about her comportment classes and her plans for the next year.
"Your mother and I miss you, Hannah. You've been gone too long from Jerholm."
"I miss you too, Papa."
"If you would only set aside these unseemly pursuits and apply yourself, I know you would be welcome back at court. Just think of how good it would be to all be together again."
"Yes, Papa."
"I don't like the idea of you remaining out here, especially with the foreign influences encroaching in these small towns. The well mother tells me a novitiate was caught with an icon of some heathen saint tucked beneath her pillow. You belong at the ice court."
"Yes, Papa."
Hannah's attempts to discuss her studies were dismissed with a wave of a hand.
"You've always been smart, Hannah, but that will not garner you a powerful husband."
"Would he not wish for a wife with whom he can discuss politics and matters of state?"
Broom sighed.
"A man who spends all day handling the country's business does not want to converse about such things with his wife. He wishes to be soothed, entertained, reminded of the gentler things in this world. The things we fight so hard to protect."
Nina stifled a gag. She wasn't sure she was going to be able to keep her excellent dinner down. As the argument between Hannah and her father became heated, she discreetly excused herself. Broom was staying at the factory, and they would hold their attack until he left in the morning. Nina used the washroom, then checked the pockets of the coat Broom had left neatly folded on the chair in the sitting room. She found a letter full of talk of the Little Lansoff, and someone named Vadik Demidov. She did her best to commit the rest of the information to memory, but she couldn't afford to be gone from the table long. Nina snuffed the candle and slipped out of the sitting room. Jarl Broom was standing in the dimly lit hall.
"Oh," she cried, letting her hand flutter to the neckline of her dress. "He startled me."
"Did you get lost on your way back from the washroom?"
"No, sir," she said, adding a hint of breathlessness to her voice. "I saw the candles were burning low and stopped to extinguish them."
"Is that not servant's work, Anka Yanderstadt?"
"Please, call me Mila."
Broom peered down at her in the gloom.
"That would not be entirely proper."
How the Fjerdens loved their propriety. But she had started to wonder if they loved to make their rules simply for the thrill of breaking them.
"Forgive me,"
she said, dropping into an unnecessarily deep curtsy. I meant no offense. I'm afraid my country manners have displeased you. Broom placed his fingers beneath her chin, but he was gentle this time as he bid her stand and tilted her face upward.
Not at all. I find them refreshing. You'll learn to navigate the company of your betters in time.
Nina lowered her eyes. If I am lucky enough to have cause to. Broom studied her.
I leave tomorrow morning, but I often pass back through Garfala to make sure the munitions factory is running smoothly.
And to oversee your experiments, Nina thought with a flash of rage.
I look forward to seeing how Hana's lessons progress.
I do not have a permanent position here, Nina said, wringing her hands. I'm not sure how long the Wellmother will tolerate my presence.
Broom placed his hand over hers and she stilled.
Such a nervous little thing. The Wellmother will always have a place for you if I say so.
Nina looked up at him with every bit of awe she could muster. She clasped his hand tightly.
Thank you, sir, she said fervently. Thank you.
They rejoined Hana in the dining room to say their goodbyes. As soon as her father was gone, Hana sagged against the wall in relief.
Thank Jell, that's over. Did you get what you needed?
Nina held up the blob of warm candle wax she'd pressed against Broom's signet ring to form a perfect impression of his seal.
I did. The rest is up to you.
Adric had been right about the problem of entering the factory. Even with Broom's seal on a military order, there was no way the guards at the eastern entrance would ever release the women and girls without a convincing Fjerdan soldier in charge. Hana did not get out of bed the next morning, claiming that the rich food of the previous night's dinner hadn't agreed with her. The Wellmother had little patience for it.
Our duties do not include seeing to a pampered girl with a fragile stomach.
Of course, Wellmother, Hana agreed. Aunt Kajanderstadt can look after me.
Then she'd bent over the side of the bed and vomited. The Wellmother pressed her sleeve to her nose to ward against the smell.
Fine. Let her empty your sick bucket and clean up your mess.
Perhaps Leonie's emetic worked a little too well, Nina said as soon as they were alone together, the door firmly closed. Hana moaned and flopped back on her pillows, looking distinctly green. Nina sat down on the bed and held a fizzing glass vial to Hana's lips.
Here, this will help. Leonie is just as good at tonics as emetics.
I hope so, said Hana. Nina cleaned up the sick room while Hana rested, then made her eat some plain bread and an egg.
You'll need your strength.
Hana propped herself up in bed, shoving a pillow behind her back. She'd left her hair unbraided in a rosy brown tumble around her shoulders, and Nina had the urge to twine each one of the thick curls around her finger.
I don't know if I can do this, said Hana. I've never tried to tailor anything before.
Nina parted the curtains to let in as much sunlight as possible. Hana's room was on the second story, so they didn't have to worry about prying eyes.
It's just another way to manipulate the body. You've seen it done. Just once, lied Nina.
Her entire face and body had been tailored to be totally unrecognizable. She'd even tried her hand at it a few times.
What if I can't put it back once I've done it?
Then we'll find someone who can, she promised. Even if I have to drag you to Hrafka to manage it.
But I really don't think it will be a problem. You're only going to make very small changes.
Nina sat down in front of Hana and held up a mirror she'd polished to perfection.
Hana gazed at herself in the glass. Where do I start?
Let's try the jaw. We'll mess with the nose once you get the hang of it. I don't want you accidentally sealing off a breathing passage.
Hana's eyes widened. I'm kidding, said Nina.
Mostly. Hana steadied her breathing and pressed her fingers gently to the left side of her own jaw.
Focus on the cells of the skin, said Nina. Think of the direction you want them to move.
This is terrifying, whispered Hana.
as the line of her jaw slowly began to shift. More terrifying than the well mother when she catches someone having a good time? A scrap of a smile curled Hannah's lips and she seemed to relax a bit. Not even close. The work took hours as Hannah strengthened her jawline, giving it a squarer shape, then added weight to her brow, and finally broadened her nose. Nina sat curled behind Hannah in the narrow bed, watching her progress in the mirror, offering suggestions and encouragement. Periodically, she would leave the room to retrieve cups of broth and pretend to empty basins, maintaining the illusion that Hannah was still ill. At last, it was time for the final touch. "Are you sure?" Nina said, holding the thick, ruddy tresses of Hannah's hair. They were shot through with gold and felt cool and silken in her hands, like fast-running water. "We could just tuck it under your cap." "I'm not going to jeopardize this whole plan for the sake of my vanity." She squeezed her eyes shut. "Do it." It felt like a crime to cut such magnificent hair, but Nina took up the shears and sliced through the thick strands. She finished the job with a razor, cropping Hannah's hair close to the skull, in the way of the Fjerdan military. Only Druskella kept their hair long. When Hannah had tailored her face back to its original state, she could claim that shaving her hair had been a penance to Jell. Nina tidied up the hair, gathering it all in a basin, and then tossed it into the garbage, making sure it was well buried. When she returned, she found Hannah sitting on her bed, staring into the mirror, tears in her eyes. "Don't cry," Nina said, shutting the door behind her and rushing to Hannah's side. "It will grow back, I promise." "It's not that," Hannah said, gazing at her face. A boy was looking back at her. The jaw, the brow, the nose, a roughening of the skin of her cheeks to make it look as if she'd shaved. They were small changes, but the effect was startling. "If I had just been a boy, if I had been the son my father wanted..." Nina gripped Hannah's shoulders. "You are perfect, Hannah. That your father can't value your strength speaks only to his weakness." Hannah looked back at the mirror, blinking her tears away. "The lips are still too full." "Leave the lips," said Nina sharply, then rose to hide her blush. "They're just right." Chapter 29. Isaac. After the chaos of the demonstration at the Gilded Bog, Isaac shouldn't have felt nervous walking into a trade meeting the following day. But there was no reason for the triumvirate to be in attendance, so he was left to face the Kirch, Kalish, and Zemini with no one but Nikolai's finance ministers. He was afraid he'd be found out. He was afraid he'd make the king look like a fool. He was afraid he'd send the Ravkin economy into a tailspin just by scratching his nose wrong. Before the meeting began, he did as Jenya and the others had suggested and met privately with his ministers.
"I'd prefer you took the lead on this, Ulyashin," he said. "I trust you to get this right."
The trade minister had beamed and happily spent the meeting debating tariffs and import taxes, all while gracefully dodging the looming specter of Ravka's loans. Isaac felt an overwhelming rush of gratitude toward Ulyashin. Perhaps he could gift him with a boat, or a title, or whatever kings did to say thank you. The meeting closed on what seemed to be a positive note, and Isaac was already heaving a sigh of relief as he rose and shook hands with the attendees. But just when he thought he was going to make his escape, Hiram Schenk cornered him and whispered furiously,
"Do you think you can continue to play games with us?"
Jenya had told him that if he got caught unawares in any situation, his best approach was to say,
"I beg your pardon,"
with as much haughty grandeur as possible. Isaac deployed that strategy now, looking down his nose with ferocious disdain.
"I beg your pardon. Didn't I recently drag your sodden daughter from a pond?"
Schenk was not deterred.
"Did you really think we would be fooled by that bit of theater last night? You were close to completing the submersibles and the missile system when we received our information months ago, and we all know that you do not rest until your inventions are perfected. You cannot continue to flirt like a debutante at a ball. We will have our prototype, or you will be treated like the pauper state you are.
Nikolai Lantsov would never have stood for such an insult. He would have replied with the perfect words to make Schenk quake with fear and wish he'd never opened his mouth.
I beg your pardon,
Isaac said firmly, and stepped past Schenk to the safety of the open door. He hurried out of the room, gut-churning, and found the twins waiting in the hall to escort him over to the next dismaying hurdle.
The Kurtz didn't buy last night's performance,
he said as they strode down the corridor. We know, said Tamar. We were listening.
Maybe the wayward missiles were too much,
Tolia said. Isaac straightened his plum-colored coat.
What do we do now?
I don't know, admitted Tamar. Let's just get through the afternoon.
A few more days,
Isaac told himself.
A few more parties, I can do this.
But where was the king? The previous night, after he'd gone to change into dry clothes, he'd overheard the others talking in the sitting room. We just have to get past the closing ball, Tamar had said as she put her arm around Jenya. Then we'll make a decision. How can there be no sign of them at all? Jenya asked with a soft sniffle. It's been nearly 3 weeks. People don't just disappear. I never thought I would say this, but I miss Zoya.
Me too,
said Tolia.
Even though I know she'd kick me for wasting time worrying about her.
I think the apparat knows something, Tamar said. He sent a request for an audience with the king to hear about his pilgrimage and demanding information on Yuri. The priest won't be put off forever. And he's been gone from the city too much for my liking. He has his own warren of tunnels leading in and out of the capital. There are too many places for him to hide.
We could get him more involved with the guests,
said Tolia.
Ask him to perform a service.
But Tamar had cut him off. We can't afford to let the priest near Isaac. He's too canny for that.
Perhaps we should have him killed,
said David. Jenya had burst into fresh tears.
When you say that, it just makes me miss Zoya more.
What comes next? Isaac wondered. He might make it through the afternoon. He might well make it through this whole series of parties and pomp without inciting any more disasters. But that didn't mean he was capable of governing a country, or even serving as some kind of figurehead while Jenya and the others did the real ruling. He rounded the corner into the portrait gallery and came upon Princess Eri and several of her guards, just as the twins' lookout had said he would. Isaac did his best to feign surprise as he greeted the princess and made small talk about the morning's entertainments. We found the weather too brisk for the garden party, said Eri.
So we thought we might stroll through the portrait gallery.
How are you finding the paintings?
They're all very stern. Just don't look too closely, thought Isaac.
Perhaps I can offer you a tour of this wing of the palace.
He could have sworn he felt the approval of her guards. They really must report Ares's successes and failures back to her sister. They passed through the blue splendor of the lapis drawing room and the concert hall, and then through some of the humbler parts of the palace, the musty trophy room, its walls crowded with stag's antlers and the heads of various big game, the armory with its old-fashioned saddles and swords, and, at last, the training rooms.
Come, let's step inside, he suggested.
The words sounded awkward and staged to his ears, but at least he knew she had a fondness for axes. Is this where your guards train?
Yes,
said Isaac. He himself had trained here and practiced with the king.
Tamar, perhaps you could give us a demonstration.
Tamar took two dulled axes from the wall. You, she said, pointing at one of the Tavgarad. She was young, her face serious, the chin sharply pointed. This had to be Mayu Kirkat, whose twin brother had gone missing and who perhaps had tired of service to the Shu crown. One of the older women stepped forward.
I will gladly spar with you.
She had a long scar across her elegant nose. Tamar cocked her head.
Is there only one lioness in this pride?
I will fight her, said the pointy-chinned girl.
Mayu,
said another of the guards softly. But Mayu stepped forward, undeterred, or perhaps anticipating the invitation. An uncomfortable current passed through the room.
Perhaps we should spar too, said Isaac.
The twins wanted the Tavgarad watching Eri, not Tamar and Mayu. He plucked a wooden sword from the wall.
I have little talent for combat, said Eri nervously.
I thought all of the Taban family were trained to defend themselves.
Of course, but my sisters are the better warriors.
Maybe I can teach you a thing or two.
Isaac didn't want to push her, but he also knew Tamar was relying on him to create a distraction while she attempted to speak to Mayu. A friendly chat while sparring wasn't ideal, but there was no other way to get one of the Tavgarad alone. Isaac tossed Eri a practice sword, and she snatched it from the air with ease.
He heard a murmur of disapproval from the Tavgarad.
Princess,
the older woman began. But Eri was already on the attack. She had radically understated her talents. She was a gifted swordswoman and moved without a hint of hesitation. Distantly, he heard the grunts of the other fighters and dared a glance at them. He saw Tamar handily knock Mayu on her behind. She leaned low when she helped the girl up, and he could only hope they were exchanging the words they needed to, assuming Mayu was the guard who wished to defect. Then the flat of Eri's sword struck him in the gut, and his breath left him with an audible oof. Eri raised a brow.
Ravka's king lacks focus.
How could anyone not be distracted by your beauty?
A weak riposte at best. Eri just laughed. She seemed more relaxed than he had ever seen her.
You have a different fighting style than I expected, she said.
Probably because you expected a king raised from birth to wield a sword, thought Isaac.
Instead, she was getting a tutor's son who hadn't touched a blade until he'd been drafted.
I might say the same of you, he replied honestly.
He had the sense that she was holding back, though he couldn't be sure. Were all the shoe princesses trained to wield a blade so well? He would be teaching her nothing. Isaac heard a cry from over his shoulder, and both he and Eri turned to see Mayu doubled over and gasping for breath.
Enough, said the older shoe guard harshly.
My apologies, Tamar said with a deep bow.
And mine as well, added Isaac.
What had happened? Had Tamar gotten the information she sought? Oh, was this all part of the plan?
I can take you to our infirmary. We...
No, gasped Mayu Kirkat. I'll be fine.
Please, said Isaac. I would hate to think one of my guests was harmed in what should have been a bit of good fun.
It was an accident, said Princess Eri. We all know this.
For a moment, the room bristled with tension, as if trouble were racing from mind to mind, looking for a place to take hold.
If I may, Princess, said Mayu, straightening. Among the shoe, amends would have to be made.
Tamar frowned.
What did you have in mind?
The guard exchanged a glance with Eri.
Perhaps a private dinner.
Tamar shook her head.
That would be seen as a sign of favoritism among the other hopefuls.
Eri looked uneasy.
We don't want to cause problems for the king.
Surely the others wouldn't need to know, said Isaac before he thought better of it.
Tamar's frown deepened, but she said,
Of course, your highness.
When Eri and her guards had gone, Tamar's frown vanished. She punched him on the arm.
Well done! Another opportunity to chase information.
But his expression must have shown his disappointment because Tamar drew back.
Oh no, Isaac. You witless podge. You like her, don't you? Don't be ridiculous, he said, feeling his cheeks heat. I know the game we're playing. What did you learn from Mayu?
Nothing. Tamar's gaze grew thoughtful. I told her I had heard she was Keb, and asked after her twin brother, but she gave me very little, only that they were from the Bol province.
Maybe she's not the one.
Possible. She was scared of something, though. and she doesn't fight as well as I'd expect. I didn't mean to hurt her, but I misjudged her reaction times. She's young and new to the ranks, so it's natural for her to be a lesser fighter than the other Tovgarad. But if she's failing in her training, she might be looking to get out before they throw her out.
Would she just go into the regular military?
After witnessing the Taban at their most vulnerable? Absolutely not. She would be exiled for her failure. She'd never see her brother or the rest of her family again.
Tamar returned her sword to the wall. It could be someone else. Or no one else. Our intelligence networks in Shu aren't really what they should be. I'll try to make sure I have time alone with each of the Tovgarad during your romantic interlude with the princess. Just make it a nice long meal.
If I must.
You yes, Sesh, Isaac, Tamar said as she gestured for a servant to put the practice room back in order.
Despise your heart. A Shu saying. Do what has to be done. He knew how he was supposed to reply, the way a Shu soldier would reply. Maybe the way a king would reply.
Niue Sesh. I have no heart.
But the words that came to mind instead were of the Kebanah and the first blossoms fall. He was not a Shu warrior and he was not a Ravkin king. He was just a peasant boy who wanted to have dinner with a girl who had been kind to him. Isaac left the room in silence. When Isaac met with Jenya and David and the twins that night in his sitting room, he expected them to be excited over the prospect of his secret dinner with Eri. Instead, it was as if he'd walked into a wake.
What is it? He asked. Is it the king?
Tolia looked grim. Tamar's expression was murderous. And Jenya looked like she'd aged 20 years. Even David had put aside his reading and looked, if not like the world was ending, at least mildly concerned.
We've had news from Fjerda, said Tamar. They're preparing to march on Ravka. It could be a week or a month, but war is coming.
Isaac sat down hard. War. They'd barely had 3 years of peace.
It gets worse, said Tolia. They're marching under the Lansoff banner.
Isaac looked up at him.
I don't understand. Their rulers have declared for Vadik Demidov. Who? He says he's a Lansov cousin, and the rightful heir to Ravka's throne. But that's nonsense, even if he is a Lansov.
His claim is supported by a man named Magnus Opier, said Jenya, a Fjerdan shipping magnate.
He was once an emissary to Ravka, Tamar continued. Opier said he had an affair with the Ravkin queen. He claims he is Nikolai's true father.
That can't be, protested Isaac. It's just Fjerdan propaganda.
He has her letters, Jenya said quietly. If they can be authenticated.
Even if they can't, said Tamar. It's enough pretext for the Fjerdans. No, Isaac said.
And stood, though he wasn't sure why.
Ravka loves their king. They will rally to his side. Maybe, said Tolia. I'd feel better if we could locate the apparat. He and most of the priest guard have gone to ground somewhere. If he backs the pretender's cause.
David shifted the book in his lap.
We probably should have had him killed.
Tamar rubbed her hands over her face.
We're going to have to make a deal with the Kerch. We need the Zemini at sea, said Tolia. Our navy is no match for the Fjerdans.
Not without Kerch money, argued Tamar.
Even then we'll need time to build.
Isaac couldn't believe what he was hearing. He opened his mouth to talk and was horrified when a slightly hysterical laugh escaped his lips.
Have you all gone mad?
They stared at him.
I'm not Nikolai Lansov. I can't lead a nation at war. This charade has to end.
For a long moment, there was quiet. At last, Jenya asked,
Is the Fjerdan delegation still here?
Yes, said Tamar. I have spies at the Ice Court, but none of this is common knowledge, even among most of their government officials.
Very well. We will see this out to the end of the week, and the final ball. When the guests are gone, we'll make a plan.
She looked up at Isaac.
One we can all live with.
The initial anticipation Isaac had felt for his dinner with Airy had been thoroughly clubbed to death by the news from Fjerda. If the king never returned, could they really ask him to live as Nikolai forever? Perhaps he should be happy at the prospect of being rich and well cared for. Wasn't this what the storybooks promised humble boys with good hearts? But Isaac knew he was no hero from a story. He was a shy boy and an average soldier who had been lucky enough to garner the king's attention. A stroke of good fortune he might pay for with his very identity. A table had been set in the woods, on the island at the center of the lake, far from the grand palace and curious eyes. The surrounding trees were hung with lanterns, and somewhere in the shadows he could hear the gentle music of a balalaika. A very romantic setting, and it would provide plenty of opportunity for Tamar to approach the Tavgarad guards, who would be stationed in the woods. Isaac had been rowed out to the island under cover of darkness. He was dressed in a teal velvet coat, one he thought suited the king's coloring particularly well. He'd found another cluster of silver beads in the pocket. He grew increasingly nervous as he waited. He was tired of luxury and fine clothes. He'd continued writing letters home, pretending that everything was as it should be at the palace. But all Isaac wanted was to sit in his mother's tiny kitchen and look out at the garden, and play cards with his little sisters. He wanted to be with people who truly knew him. Would they know him? They certainly wouldn't recognize him. Every day he passed by his fellow palace guards, men he'd known for years, and there were moments when he wanted to shout, "It's me, Isaac Andreev." His captain had been told that he was needed in Oskarvo for translation work, and that was the end of it. It had been that easy to simply make him disappear. At last, Tolia said,
"She's coming."
Airy moved slowly into the clearing. She had been robed in embroidered grass-green silk and an elaborate gold headdress, studded with emeralds as large as a thumbnail.
"How much does it weigh?"
he whispered when they were seated and the first course was served.
"I'm not sure," said Airy, "but it feels like a team of pack animals is sitting on my head. So somewhere between 2 and 12 oxen."
"Do they make you train your neck muscles?"
"Of course not. The women of the Taban line are born with strong necks, a gift of divine purpose."
"Silly me."
He felt himself relax. Airy was simply easier to talk to than everyone. The twins, Jenya, David, certainly the other hopefuls. The other prospective brides seemed to carefully pick and choose their words, saying the things that Isaac, or rather Nikolai, would want to hear. But Airy didn't seem to care very much about being chosen as his bride. It was a thought that both comforted and distressed him. He had no doubt she would have been smitten with the real Nikolai, and that made him jealous of a man she'd never met. Airy glanced down at her plate. "What has your cook served us tonight?"
"Something in jelly. He seems to believe that if you can put it in aspic, you absolutely should."
"What's your favorite thing to eat?"
"My mother's cabbage rolls."
"The queen cooked?" "Damn it."
"Well, the servants made it, but my mother would serve it to me when I was sick."
He had no idea if such a thing was likely, but it sounded all right.
"What about you?"
he asked hurriedly. She thought for a long moment.
"There is a dish we only eat once a year during the spring festivals. Milk pudding molded to look like the moon and flavored with rose water. I know it doesn't sound very good, but it's the tradition of the way it's eaten. You sit with all of your family, and you tell stories and watch fireworks, and you try to make the pudding last the whole night."
"Even the royal family does this?"
She nodded slowly.
"Yes, though it's been a long time since we were all together. I sometimes wonder if we ever will be again."
"You mean if you wed and come to live in Ravka?"
She blinked away the shine of tears.
"Yes." Isaac found himself panicking at the sight of her unhappiness.
I would gladly let you visit whenever you liked."
He had no idea if that was a promise a king could keep.
Let's not think on it, Eri said, dabbing the tears from her eyes with her napkin. We are here now, and we should try to enjoy ourselves. She took a bite, and he watched her face contort as she swallowed. With a glance at the guards at the edge of the trees, Isaac discreetly tilted his plate and let the jellied lump slide onto the forest floor, nudging it beneath the table with his boot. Eri grinned and followed suit. Together they endured several courses and many jellies, celebrated the solid and highly recognizable venison steak, and agreed that whatever the gray stuff was, it was delicious. It's difficult, isn't it? She asked at last. To sit here and pretend our countries are not enemies.
Do they have to be? Said Isaac.
The words sounded clumsy and unsophisticated, or dangerously like a proposal. It isn't up to me, she said. I am not a queen. I am not anyone.
You're a princess, Isaac exclaimed.
Eri touched her fingertips to her headdress. But do you ever feel like... well, like a fraud?
Every day.
But what would Nikolai say? Isaac suddenly didn't care.
Yes, I do. All the time.
Eri leaned forward. If people didn't bow to me, if they didn't dress me in silks and kiss my hem, would I still be a princess, or would I just be a girl with a fancy colander on her head? Isaac laughed.
It's a good question. All I know is I don't feel like a king.
What do you feel?
Tired, he said honestly. Ready for a cabbage roll.
We've just eaten 7 courses.
Are you full?
Not remotely. Perhaps dessert is another steak. Isaac laughed again. He took a sip of the iced wine that had been served with the last course and asked Eri the same question he'd been putting to himself.
If you were destined to be queen and not your sister.
Eri's brows rose, and Isaac knew he was in tricky territory. Monarchs did not speculate idly.
How would you rule the shoe?
Eri toyed with the stem of her glass. Isaac had the urge to take her hand, but he knew that wasn't permitted. Strange that a king could command an army, but he couldn't hold the hand of a girl he liked. And he did like Eri. He'd been smitten with Jenya, overwhelmed by her status and the idea that such a woman might take notice of him. Eri was different. It was true that he barely knew her. She was a princess born of ancient royal blood. She sat before him wearing enough emeralds to buy and sell the entirety of Isaac's hometown, but she surprised him at every turn. She was warm and thoughtful and seemed to care as little for pretense as he did. If they'd been 2 ordinary people, if they'd met at a village dance instead of in a room surrounded by courtiers, Isaac had to wonder at himself.
As if you'd ever have had the nerve to talk to a girl like this.
But maybe Eri, kind and funny Eri, would have taken pity and granted him a dance. How would I rule? Eri mused, lifting the glass to her lips.
You must have considered it.
Those are dangerous thoughts for one such as me. Eri shook her head slowly, the emeralds glinting in her hair. The things I imagine. The things I would hope for are not the musings of a queen.
A princess, then?
Eri smiled. More like an artless girl. An end to war, a chance for the common people to choose their own futures. A world in which families aren't torn apart by hardship or duty. I must sound very foolish to you.
Not at all, said Isaac. If we don't dream, who will?
Eri nodded, but her smile was tinged with sadness. If we don't dream, who will? The last course had been served. Soon guards would come to fetch them away. As anxious as Isaac had been, he found he was sorry the evening was over.
Will you return home immediately after the ball at the end of the week?
He asked. Yes. He didn't think he imagined the regret in her eyes,
Meet me in the conservatory during the ball, he said before he could stop himself. Otherwise, we'll never have a real moment alone.